Welcome to Slate's I Have to Ask. I'm Isaac Chotiner. My guest today is James Wood, a staff writer at The New Yorker, widely considered one of the most influential literary critics of his generation. Prior to joining the magazine, he was a book critic for The Guardian and The New Republic. And this month, he is releasing a novel of his own, which is called Upstate, and which tells the story of an English father visiting his grown daughter in upstate New York along with her sister. Wood himself, who was born in England, lives in Massachusetts with his wife, the novelist Claire Massoud. And it is from his home in Cambridge, I believe, where he joins me now. Hi, James. Are you in Cambridge?
Hi, Isaac. I am.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the program.
Pleasure.
So tell me, how is the process of writing a novel different from the process of writing an essay? This may seem like an obvious question, but I'm curious for you how it's different.
So the main difference is a pretty obvious one, of course, and that has to do with temporality. A review is written fairly quickly. It has a limited project. A novel, I guess, could take an infinite amount of time. This one took, despite being short, took quite a long time because it kept on being interrupted. So I actually began it about 3 or 4 years ago and then stopped writing for 7 or 8 months. And as things got in the way, having to earn a living, being a dad, that sort of thing. So that's one basic difference. And I suppose another important one is that, and I think here this is a deeper point, that I think one has to suspend thinking about an audience. That, I mean, when you write journalism, an audience is sort of built into the, it's structurally built into the relationship. You're writing it for an editor who's going to see it in a day or two, and then the next week it will be out, and there's a sort of known quantity, a known audience will be consuming that review, even if it's a small amount of people. With a novel, I think you just have to, you can't know what that is or think about it, and you have to put it aside, and I think that is freeing too. And then, of course, there's the probably the way where you were heading with your question, which is the even deeper question of what faculties are engaged when one is writing creatively as opposed to critically.
Well, so what are the answers to that last part then?
These, I saved it for last because these are the ones I find hard to talk about. I at least find I can't turn off the critical monitor quite how I would like to. And I have come to the conclusion, or perhaps I've just reconciled myself to that inability, but I've come to the conclusion that isn't such a bad thing. That maintaining a critical consciousness at least enables me to review myself, edit myself, think twice and three times about everything I'm doing, and all the other elements that, of course, are part of any creative endeavor. So I've sort of cautiously come to embrace that inability to turn off the critical side.
Do you think it limits perhaps the type of novel you could write, even if not the quality of a specific novel, to be unable to turn off that side of your brain, or do you think it's on the whole just a?
Yeah, I think possibly it does. I think there's a kind of there's this beautiful phrase I love from V.S. Pritchett where he talks about how Ford Madox Ford was unable to fall into the relaxed stupor that the great artist, you know, he was thinking of, I don't know, Proust or someone like that, is able to do. And that sort of relaxed stupor, that kind of being almost half asleep, allows a certain kind of allows us a kind of freedom which I'm not able to find.
You said that it helped you when you're sort of editing your book or going through it. Have you sort of gone through the process of reading your book the way you would read a novel that you're going to review, you know, with your pencil and you're sitting in your chair and you're checking off what you would the way you're, you know, writing about some book for The New Yorker?
Oh, yeah, most certainly. In fact, much more systematically and chronically. That's to say, you know, again, the review is a limited endeavor. You might, at most, you might be able to read a book twice, though that doesn't happen much in practice. And then it's gone, living with this manuscript, thinking critically about it. And then it has to be said, even after it's been sent off to the publisher, sort of waking up and finding that half of what you've done doesn't please you. I found it to be sort of an intensely self-critical activity. So yeah, I was constantly writing my worst possible reviews.
The thing you said about not writing for an audience was interesting. I mean, your wife is obviously a novelist. You know a lot of novelists. Is that sort of universal? Because that didn't strike me as obvious that novelists, and obviously I'm not talking about Dan Brown or something, but that novelists are not necessarily writing for an audience. Is it just because the work itself is more personal than a book review is? I mean, why do you think that's the case?
I think so. Certainly in my case, I felt that it was important to please myself, and that part of following a creative line means, of course, part of it is simply going somewhere where you didn't know you would go, and that is a beautiful experience that I think writers talk about, and they encounter that, and I did from time to time while I was writing this novel, of just letting the material generate its own energies and direction. But for me, I found it, yeah, I just felt it was important that I please myself, and that meant, as it were, not pleasing an audience, which meant further not even relating to a potential audience. I don't know how other writers think about this, though I think increasingly that literary writers are going to have to stop thinking about audiences, because I don't know that they have much grasp anymore of what the components of that audience is.
Your book, which I mentioned in the intro, is about fathers and daughters, or a father and daughters. Why do you think there aren't more books written about the father-daughter relationship compared to the other possible parent-child relationships?
That is a very good question, because it seems, you're right. I mean, fiction is absolutely dominated by same gender relationships, and then even further dominated by, it has to be said, father and son relationships. I guess that writers feel that there's a kind of, there's an intense internal struggle that is more dynamic somehow if it's within the gender, and perhaps more violent in its nature. But for me, the interest really starts when the genders cross. That's where it's really interesting. So I was absolutely sure that I wanted to write about a father and two daughters.
Is that because of your own experience as a father?
Yeah, I have a elder daughter and a younger son, and the household I grew up in, I had a sort of an easy relationship in some ways with my dad, but it could be said I had a fairly boring one too, and that all the energy actually was cross gender. So the fierceness in my family and all the authority was from my mum. So my schooling, as it were, as a kid was in how to manage the parent who wasn't male. So maybe it came out of that. I don't know.
You know, you're a novelist because I'm asking you boring novelist questions like how much of this is drawn from real life. But
I'm happy to talk about that.
How old's your daughter now?
She's 16.
Has she read the book?
She's not read the book. And I don't want to get too autobiographical, but I will say that, I mean, I just mentioned two families, the one which I've partly created and the one that I was born into. And in both those cases, there have, of course, been happy experiences and unhappy experiences. Certainly when I was growing up, my mother was sort of fierce and somewhat abusive even, and quite unhappy. There was a lot of depression around, and it didn't seem to be something that afflicted my dad in the same way. So I think from an early age, I was trying to consider these issues, why one person and not the other, how these things are distributed, and then how, of course, are they handed on to the children of those people. I'm I'm one of three siblings, and looking at the three of us, there would seem also to be a kind of uneven, somewhat unfair, and apparently random distribution of happiness and unhappiness, or just call it stability and instability. And then when you have kids yourself, you begin to think about this just at the basic level of noticing how very different one child is from the other and how little control you had over that and will have over that.
Last personal question. I had your wife on the show about 6 months ago. I think you're the first husband-wife pair to ever appear. So congratulations. She said, I asked her what it was like to have a husband who's a literary critic and she being a novelist reading her work and vice versa, you know, and she said it's harder for him in the situation than me. I think she meant that he's the one who has to read my novels and give comments on it. So it's harder than me reading his literary essays. So what is that like now that the situation is reversed and you're writing novels? I mean, I know you've written fiction before, but that you've spent the last couple of years writing a novel and she's reading it.
I wouldn't say, I don't know if it was harder or less hard, but it was incredibly useful because, of course, she's able to encourage me when I feel like it's gone flat and dead and I haven't written anything for 4 months or something. So she was very good just at that practical level. And then she was the first reader when the manuscript was finished. And that was immensely helpful because she read it and said, you know, with a novelist's eye, she sort of said, this is fine, but there are a couple of lines that I would, that seem to have been snipped off too early that you need to continue right to the end of the book, and really showed me how to do that. So that was, that was splendid.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
To change topics a little bit here.
You bet.
Do you find yourself reading, if you go back and read old novels or even more current novels of, let's say, misbehaving men, that you are reading them from a different perspective at all these days? Or have you thought anew about engaging with literature that is created by people who may not have been the best people in their personal lives?
Sure. I think I know where you're going with the question. I was just thinking about this last week when Philip Roth died. When I pretty much arrived at Harvard in 2003, maybe 2 years later, I taught Sabbath Theatre, a book I very much admire. And certainly a problematic book about a misbehaving man. Also, I think a tragic book about a certain burden of male sexuality. And that's how I taught it. But I don't think I would teach that book now. I would probably be a little too anxious about my ability to pull it off as a teacher. I think things have changed. That said, you know, going way back to my late 20s, I was always, you know, whatever I wrote about John Updike, I was always very critical of had no time for the sort of misogyny and so on. It just, you know, had. So I don't know. I think there are specific, perhaps institutional things that have changed, but I don't know that my understanding, particularly of that post-war generation of male writers, has changed very much. They've always seemed a fairly flawed bunch of people to me, particularly in the way they write about women or don't even admit women into their fictions.
When you say you wonder about your ability to pull it off, do you think, does that mean that you think the consciousness of students has changed and so they would respond differently to the same lesson? Does it mean that you feel like maybe you weren't talking about it properly and now you're aware that you weren't talking about it properly? I guess, what exactly do you mean by that?
No, I don't think that. That's to say, I think I would teach it almost exactly as I did in 2005 when I distinctly remember we talked about the misogyny, but then we also tried to talk about how the novel is pretty critical of a kind of sort of vicious, sort of unbridled male sexuality. No, actually, what I mean is, it's almost a thing of it's really almost a thing as basic as speech acts. That's to say, I don't think what I say would be different. There are literally passages that I read out in 2005 that I would feel anxious about reading out now.
And anxious, I guess I just mean, what do you mean by anxious? That your students would feel anxious? Is that the...
Yeah. I think people, I mean, it wasn't easy in 2005. I was aware that there were certain students were sort of, you know, leave. It was a lecture. So people could come and go, but there was a certain sense of, you know, the room was getting a little emptier, over the 3 weeks. I think that we discussed that novel, and that's fine. But yes, I think there would be the slight fear now that some of the energy of that, of the comedy of that novel, would be unspeakable.
Have you ever taught Lolita, by the way?
I never have done, though. It doesn't lack for... I used to joke that the two novels at Harvard that you could guarantee everyone had read were To the Lighthouse and Lolita, because they were always taught in sort of four or five multiple overlapping classes. So they certainly do encounter Lolita, but I've never taught it.
Along the lines of what you're saying, it feels like we're kind of at a point in American culture where, with a lot of the criticism of art and books, that the political has kind of been raised up, and aesthetic judgments are sort of talked about less than they were, and the politics of the work under consideration is talked about more. And I think that there are obvious reasons for that, that things are becoming more politicized, some good, maybe some not so good. Do you feel that reading criticism, and how do you feel about it?
I do. I've actually, I felt it. I felt that to be a movement that certainly predates the, you know, the Trump administration, and also predates the Me Too movement. I mean, for some time now, I probably, even going back to say my book How Fiction Works, when that came out in 2008, I've felt that I've been to some extent fighting a somewhat sort of rearguard activity as a formalist, and having to make a case as a formalist, as someone who tends to aesthetic matters in a way that perhaps wasn't true, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. I have noticed that. And actually, the politicization of everything only makes me more keen to secure a kind of a sort of sacred space. You know, I like the idea of form as something that draws a circle around material that will be utterly changed within that circle, and that is also set apart somewhat from contemporary political issues. Do you know what I mean? It's not, it seems important to, I guess I find myself drawn more and more to pieces of music or poems or certain novels that don't have much to say directly about our contemporary issues, and that seem to have this sort of formal band around them, within which there is a kind of stillness almost.
Right. I think the response to that would be that there were all these pieces of art before that were political in some way, and we did not perceive them as political because sort of our ingrained biases, or, you know, that colonialism Absolutely. Was taken at face value or whatever, and so it wasn't even discussed. Totally. But I also find myself perusing newspapers or magazines wanting to read things, or books, wanting to just completely get away from anything that even seems remotely political.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think we're all, you know, we're all sort of exhausted by our minute by minute, which is deliberate, of course, involvement with the undulating narrative of the Trump administration. So that I think anything just at that level, anything that isn't speaking to that day to day burden seems like a liberation.
You coined a term called hysterical realism about 18 years ago, mm-hmm. reviewing Zadie Smith's first novel, White Teeth. And for people who haven't read your piece or haven't heard the term hysterical realism, well, do you want to just define it quickly?
Sure. I don't know how much, you know, whether it has much coinage anymore or whether it should indeed have much coinage. It was, for me, a way of talking about a kind of comedy that in fiction that seemed intent on, I guess, a sort of slightly bogus vitality, which tended towards caricature and zaniness and extremity rather than the subtler arts of comedy, and also tended to swerve away from something that I think is one of the central strands in the novelistic tradition, which is tragicomedy, the sort of comedy that makes you cry, the laughter through tears kind of tradition, which I think is really, in a way, the novel's invention.
Right. My colleague Laura Miller, in a piece talking about this, said the novels that you were writing about, that, quote, they're big, they're full of information, ideas, and stylistic riffs. They have eventful plots that transpire on what's often called a broad social canvas. They experiment with form and voice. They're overtly, or maybe just overly, smart. I guess the question that I want to ask you, a friend of mine suggested this, and it hadn't occurred to me, and mm-hmm. I thought it was very interesting, which is that, have you thought about your critique of hysterical realism now, given how hysterical the world we're living in actually is, how hysterical reality actually is in the last couple of years? And I know over time people may often feel like they're living in a hysterical reality, but this does seem like a unique moment in all kinds of ways. And so I was wondering if you've kind of thought about how someone could capture reality now without being slightly hysterical.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. So just to back up for a second, I have, of course, rethought that whole critique, and sometimes probably to please myself or justify myself more than anything else, I've tended to reformulate it so that I now think sometimes when I look back at that essay, it wasn't so much the hysteria side of things I was criticizing as in some ways the realism side of things. That's to say, there were two parts of that critique. The critique was about a kind of comedy, but the critique was also about a certain way in which those novelists were at once very unrealistic, but at the same time, in terms of the grammar of the fiction, were just following a fairly boring realism. They didn't seem to me to be doing anything very interesting with form. But you're right. Of course, that feeling of the novel being in competition, particularly with American reality, is not a new one. You could probably say it goes all the way back to sort of Melville's, you know, The Confidence Man. But the aforementioned Philip Roth famously talked in the early 60s about American reality sort of, you know, outdoing fiction's abilities to catch up. And I suppose here's what I wouldn't change. We're in hysterically unreal times, but does it follow that the novel, which, as you rightly suggest, is always to some extent about disclosing reality, does it follow that the novel is trying to mirror or embody that? Or is the novel doing something related to, but subtly different from that kind of lived experience of hysteria? In other words, I think you could make a case that precisely what we don't need now is fiction that exactly maps onto the anxiety of our times.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember reading a Salman Rushdie quote, which I always thought was a strange way of looking at things, where he essentially says about writing about India, he says, India is a big place, a crowded place. It's hot. There's tons of energy. And so prose to capture India essentially needs to be all those things. And I thought that's kind of a category error of some sort.
Absolutely, and was brilliantly critiqued both in essayistic form and in the form of his own fiction by the Anglo-Indian writer Amit Chowdhury, who's been very good on this. This idea of sort of, you know, this mimetic fallacy, this idea that you just you fill up the form with the thing it's representing, and then it looks like the thing it's representing. It should be said again, that's an interesting. It's interestingly written into, I think, the American challenge. It's written into the project of the great American novel. It's written into, say, Whitman's work when Whitman says America is the greatest poem. And so it's not going to go away, I think, as a particular kind of fraughtness for American writers.
Just to add to what you were saying about Roth, old essay of yours, you wrote about Roth. He has shown that postmodern artifice and American realism are not incompatible, but actually feed each other. Perhaps his greatest novel, The Counterlife, takes what it needs from postmodern self-consciousness and fictive games and mounts a moving inquiry into what it means to lead a life. Before we go, I just I was hoping you would if you had anything else to say about Philip Roth, what he meant to you as a writer, and now with his death, what you think his legacy is in American fiction.
Totally. And I do think he was the great stealth postmodernist. And it's the obvious difference between him and the other Jewish American writer that he adored above all, Saul Bellow, who essentially was not an experimentalist in any way. There was play at the level of sentence, but it wasn't about essentially changing the forms. With Roth, it wasn't just that he was interested in, you know, veils of fictionality, alter egos, and so on. He really liked the challenge of form. He really liked to tell a story one way, then to tell it the other way. He liked splitting characters up in the way he did, say, in Operation Shylock. And he liked writing essentially about himself. So in all these interesting ways, I mean, if you look at what's currently energetic in American writing, autobiography, autofiction, essayism, Roth was there 20 years earlier. Particularly with a book like the Counterlife, which I very much admire. So it's a massive loss, and I think all of us thought, you know, he partly that he would just live forever in that way that one does, but also I think we all hoped that maybe he hadn't retired and was quietly writing the final sort of brilliantly posthumous. Should we say devastatingly posthumous critique of us all to be published after his death. But maybe we'll discover that was the case all along.
Last thing, another writer who passed away within the last month or so is Tom Wolfe, who also was someone who left a big imprint on American letters in terms of both fiction and nonfiction, and liked to play around with ideas of realism and hysterical realism, let's say, both. Yeah. What are your feelings of about Tom Wolfe and his legacy?
So I can see that the journalism was important when it came out, and it belonged to, you rightly say, I mean, there were two ways of responding to the 60s. There was loud, because the time is loud, and that was Wolfe and many others. And then there was quiet, like Joan Didion, where you were fiercely filtering everything. And I suppose I'm going to sound very contrary if I say that some of the loudness irritates me in Wolfe, but also some of the quietness in Didion seems too filtered to me now. And I guess I want something in the middle. But the journalism is important and will obviously last. I couldn't bear his fiction because it took from the hysteria of the journalism, or it transferred it directly to the fiction. And you find that there's no individuation in Woolf's novels. Everyone thinks and speaks in exactly the same way, which is to say, loudly. So there's literally no, if you think of it in musical terms, there's no attention to dynamics. It's as if the orchestra or the band is just playing at full volume for a 5-hour gig, and then you just collapse with bleeding ears at the end of it. It's appalling.
Yeah. A Man in Full is the worst long novel that I've actually finished, or the longest worst novel that I've actually finished to the end and not quit. Maybe that's...
Well, and also very interesting that the writer, it shows how, I perhaps shouldn't say this because I'm offering up a hostage to fortune when I say it, but it shows that it isn't always an easy thing to move from one genre to another. In other words, the qualities that made his journalism interesting, for instance, a playfulness with form and this sort of ear for excess, they don't work at all in his fiction. And of course, in fictional terms, he's a completely traditional. There's no experimentation whatsoever. Any boldness there was in the journalism isn't there in the fiction at all. It's a completely lazy inheritance of sort of essentially popular realist grammar.
Yeah, someone like Zadie Smith, or someone who can write essays, yeah, and write fiction at extremely high levels and do different things with both is the exception.
Indeed.
Rather than the norm.
I agree.
James Wood is the author of the novel Upstate, which is out now and which you can pick up at Amazon or even better, your local bookstore. James, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Isaac.
And that's our show for today. I Have to Ask is produced by Max Jacobs. Thanks to Shasha Leonard at Slate Studios in Brooklyn. If you have an idea for a guest, you just want to let me know your thoughts, email me at ask@slate.com. That's ask@slate.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter at iChotner for more information about the show. Thanks for listening.